FT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We'd love to give you the latest. Plus, you're already on Facebook. Why not get behind the scenes of Houston's leader for independent music, arts, ideas, and culture right now? Again, find us at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. See you there.
Signals it is once again 8 p.m. on Thursday, and time for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston, Texas, devoted entirely to storytelling, right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. I'm your host, Greg Audell, and alongside what I truly consider to be the absolute best team on radio, Drs. Hank Rubicek, Warren Holloman, and Mary Edgerton, our wonderful guest host who often sit in and give us a spell from time to time, our engineer extraordinaire, Tatiana Gago, who makes sure you can hear us crisply and cleanly, while also making sure you don't hear our coughs or our hiccups. And I'm fighting a cough tonight, so we'll try and make sure you don't have to suffer through it. And of course, Floyd the Wonder Dog, who is asleep in my lap as we sleep. He's long stopped being impressed with the glamorous life of public radio. So What's Your Story has been celebrating the power of story for almost 10 years by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on astounding, riveting, challenging, and fascinating journeys before returning us safely and usually gently to the present, all within a very few minutes. That's the beauty of storytelling, friends. It is the cheapest round-trip ticket in the world. Yet it can take you absolutely anywhere with no advance reservations required. There is simply no better bargain to be found. Tonight, we'll be focusing on the one thing everyone needs in their life at some point. Some of us consistently. That is healing. In The Healing Art of Storytelling, Author Richard Stone identifies the term destorification, which he describes as the growing absence of the need for story in our society. He sees a large part of destorification stemming from the growth of technology in our society that separates people from the need to interact with each other through the telling of stories, which I think is tragic. Stone's unfortunate conclusion is that without stories, life becomes a book cover completely devoid of pages. Nice to see, but not very fulfilling. Vanessa Jackson, president of Healing Circle, agrees and claims that the spaces for people to tell stories are completely disappearing. She insists that we must reintroduce opportunities for storytelling in our families, in our neighborhoods, and even in international communities. These two experts are not alone, because tonight's guest, I think, completely agrees. And because she is a psychologist, storyteller, and a wonderful friend of this program, the art of healing and storytelling will connect more vividly with her help. She is Sneha Desai. Dr. Desai is a licensed psychologist who works with individuals of all ages in the Clear Lake area. When she's not at work, she spends time acting and modeling for Houston-based productions, writing short stories, and most importantly, managing her dog's Instagram account, whose address we'll give you a bit later. Sneha Desai, welcome once again to So What's Your Story? It is a pleasure to have you back in our studio.
I'm so happy to be back here this evening. It's always an honor for me to be on So What's Your Story and share all my experiences with everyone.
Well, I'll tell you, we work hard to bring you what I think are the best guests. And, you know, some are serious, some are fun, and Sneha just knocks it out of the park every time.
Thank you.
It's absolutely true. The road to healing is not a foreign one to you, and you know just how bumpy that road can be. Would you share your first story with us?
Sure. So this is a story that I never get tired of sharing. About 7 years ago, I became a fanatic about Zumba. Zumba at 8 a.m., Zumba at 8 p.m. I would drive from gym to gym to take as many Zumba classes as I could in one day. In fact, my dream was to become a Zumba instructor. One night, I overdid it. I woke up the next morning with pain in my right big toe. I dismissed it to nothing. I braved it. In fact, I even walked to the rodeo with my injured foot, almost willing it to go away. When after 2 weeks nothing had improved, I went to a podiatrist. He diagnosed me with tendonitis and asked me to get some rest. As the pain worsened, they put me in a boot and I hobbled around in tears. After 6 weeks, the podiatrist suspected that I had something else going on and sent me to an orthopedic doctor. While the doctor did not see me, but his assistant saw, and she told me that she thought I had gout and offered to put me in a cast, asked me to change my diet, and gave me a steroid shot in my toe. I did everything they asked me to, but there was still no change. So I decided to go to a rheumatologist who told me that nothing about my presentation looked like gout, and they suspected a neurological condition and sent me to a pain management doctor. By this time, 3 months had already passed. I'd now begun to use a walker to transport myself to places. The pain management doctor ordered a lot of tests, 4 or 5 tests, after which I was informed that I had tarsal tunnel syndrome. It's like carpal tunnel, but in your foot. Apparently, I needed surgery to get this fixed, and I was sent over to a whole new podiatrist. The thought of surgery was so scary. I had never had surgery in my life before, but the pain was beginning to be unbearable. I had developed something called allodynia, which is extreme pain caused by something touching you. A cotton ball, a feather, a pebble, even breeze from the fan caused me so much pain to the point that I was moved to tears. Needless to say, when the podiatrist examined my foot, I wouldn't let him touch me, and I pushed him away as hard as I could. He looked at me and said, "Look, you don't have tarsal tunnel syndrome because no one with this syndrome acts the way you are. I think you have complex regional pain syndrome." I came home thinking I had received yet another diagnosis. I was getting tired of the runaround. But when I researched the disorder, all of the symptoms that I was experiencing were all of the symptoms that were listed. I was so relieved that I finally had the answer. However, the disorder seemed horrific, particularly the fact that it has no cure. At this point, I started calling neurologists and pain management doctors all over Houston to see if I could get in just to confirm my diagnosis. To my amazement, most doctors did not even know what the condition was, and the ones that did not have an opening for at least 3 months. Time was running out for me. My husband and I started reading scholarly articles on CRPS and began to research where the authors were based out of. One such article was written by Dr. Abdi at MD Anderson, thankfully based in Houston. I called MD Anderson the very next day. The first thing they asked me, "Do you have cancer?" And when I said no, they said that they only saw patients with cancer. I felt so exasperated and frustrated and desperate. So I Googled Dr. Abdi's email address. I sent him a long email filled with a rant and asked him, Why is it so hard for someone to get to see a professional just for the sake of a correct diagnosis? To my surprise, Dr. Abdi responded to me within 3 hours. He informed me that he would see me, to call back, to schedule an appointment, and I was seen within 2 weeks of that email. During that visit, Dr. Abdi looked at my foot, which by that time had turned purple, was shiny, distorted, and it had shrunk from a lack of use, and confirmed that I indeed had CRPS. He told me that I had some hope of going into remission if we got some treatment in within 6 months of onset. I was already on my 5-month mark. We all sprung into action. He scheduled me for nerve blocks in my spine for 3 consecutive weeks, and miraculously, they worked. My allodynia reduced a great deal. I went to physical therapy to relearn how to walk in the swimming pool, and the quality of my life started improving. It has been 5 years since. I still have CRPS, and I still have some hard days. Unfortunately, I cannot work out, so my dream of becoming a Zumba instructor still remains a dream. But I can walk again, and that, to me, is my biggest achievement today.
Wow, what a terrifying experience.
It was.
You know, I'm interested, since you are a doctor, I mean, I think the public is under the impression from watching TV shows that you go to the doctor, they tell you what's wrong, they come up with a treatment plan, and you're probably better within an hour or so. As a professional, were you dismayed by just the process of identifying it?
I was dismayed by the ignorance that existed about this disorder because it is such a rare one. I've spoken to many doctors who are friends since then, and they tell me that they were taught about this disorder for barely 30 minutes in all of their med school. So after knowing that fact, it wasn't a surprise, but it was, as a patient then, it was very frustrating for me to see that the answers were not coming soon enough.
Is Zumba a common cause of this ailment?
No, it's not Zumba, but CRPS can be caused by an injury.
I see.
So I believe that I genuinely had an injury. The injury went away, but the nervous system had a dysfunction. So it believes that the injury is still present, and it keeps sending pain signals to the limb that was injured.
And if you weren't so diligent, so intelligent, so connected, would you ever have been diagnosed?
I think that there are a lot of unfortunate people out there who have not been diagnosed correctly because they've just listened to the professionals and not done any of their research on their own.
I think you'll agree that you must be your best advocate.
Absolutely.
Again, George Clooney is not going to come in your hospital room and lay it all out for you. You've got to be your best detective and your best advocate because no one's going to do it for you, no matter what you think. And I'm going to give a shout out to my favorite Zumbaologist, Hannah Catherine out there, who I know is listening. And she's my favorite Zumba addict.
Aw.
She's also my niece. Well, the road to recovery certainly sounds like it's been treacherous. It's also full of valuable lessons, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you pay attention to them and don't just get so frustrated by the pain and agony of illness.
Yeah, well, I believe that everything happens for the best. It's like a yin-yang theory, you know? Every cloud has a silver lining and every rose has a thorn.
That's true. It really is true. Yeah, I think it's easy to struggle with that, but when you step back a little bit, you know, even the agony, you've learned a great deal from and usually met some pretty special people along the way.
Absolutely. I appreciate my husband, who has been a huge support throughout this process, Dr. Abdi, who was so diligent about treating me right away and saw me despite me not having cancer, you know. And this story today has been very special for me, especially because not only is it one about hope and persistence, but also September is Pain Awareness Month. And I think it is pretty apt.
Well, that's one reason why we wanted to do this show tonight, because, you know, it's easy to look at everyone's Facebook pages and things, wow, everyone's life is perfect. And if you have an illness, an ongoing illness, it's easy to think you're the only one. Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear your second story that's following on this topic.
Sure. So I grew up in India, and India is the land of Bollywood, the biggest film industry in the world. And my only dream as a child was to become a model or an actress. I remember that I was as little as six when I would stand by the mirror all day practicing different facial expressions, poses, smiles, and whatnot. My mother wasn't pleased. She wanted me to be a doctor or an engineer, you know, one of those cliched occupations in the Indian population. And one of her tactics to keep me on that path was to keep my hair short so that I don't get too arrogant. For some reason, she thought the longer hair I had, the more vain I would become. And I hated my short hair. I would tell her that I wanted longer hair so that I could tie it into two ponytails and shake my ponytails. And everyone thought that was so cute, but she wasn't having it. I did manage to strike a deal with her. She told me that if I would braid my own hair in the mornings for school, she would allow me to have longer hair. So I did. By the time I turned 8, I was able to take care of my hair exactly the way my strict Catholic school wanted me to. I oiled my hair, I had 2 thick braids and black ribbons, and on weekends, I was allowed to let my hair loose and pretend I was a Bollywood actress. And along the way, I acted in some plays at school and thoroughly enjoyed the attention I received. When I was in the first year of college, my grandfather, the only person I was close to in my family, passed away unexpectedly. In order to cope with his loss, I resorted to food. I binged on carbs. My staple diet became bread, cheese, and chocolate. And from being at 110 pounds, I grew to 150 pounds in 1 year. And in a land where a size 4 is the norm for a college student, I began to be ridiculed for my size. I was called a buffalo, a hippo, a cow, and was told by so many people in my family and outside of my family that no one would marry me because of my weight. And at 5 feet 2 inches and 150 pounds, modeling and acting as a career was definitely out of the question for me. And because of the bullying, my self-esteem crashed and I began to feel very ugly. Thankfully, my desire to be a successful college student did not diminish. I graduated with the highest grades in college and I moved to the United States for a master's degree in clinical psychology. That was the first time I was so far away from home and was living independently. I had to learn how to do my laundry. I cooked and cleaned for the first time. I opened up a bank account for the first time. I didn't have a car, so I was walking to campus, and I started discovering who I was as an adult. And I began admiring all my classmates who would wear makeup and matching accessories and styled hair to classes. And I thought everyone around me looked like Hollywood actresses. And I began to be inspired by them and started taking care of myself and began to lose the weight I had gained in college. And remember how I mentioned being a Zumba fanatic? I believe that obsession came from the power that I felt when I started losing weight and did not want to go back to being viewed as fat and ugly. However, when I developed complex regional pain syndrome, I was unable to exercise. And the medication that I was put on for the pain had the side effects of weight gain. So by the time I landed into Dr. Abdi's office at MD Anderson, I had gained over 10 pounds and I was complaining about how ugly I had started to look, despite the bigger problem being that I was unable to walk. The first time I was in his office, I was extremely overwhelmed. I had begun to lose hope of ever walking again. Forget about exercising. I felt undesirable. I was upset that I did not have the energy to do my hair, which because it's wavy, it's forever unruly. Or I did not have the energy to do the makeup that I wanted, and I did not look as professional as I would have liked to. After my 20-minute visit with him, where he offered me all the treatment solutions that I went through and instilled more hope in me, I walked out with relief. That's when I noticed something that I had not noticed earlier while I was waiting to be called in. The waiting room was filled with people wearing masks, on crutches, looking rather frail, ill, and with no hair. I felt a mixed bag of emotions in that moment. Shame for the way I was thinking, shock at what I was seeing, fear at what could be, guilt, sadness, and most importantly, an aha moment. Here I was worrying about how much weight I was gaining and about how frizzy my hair looked in the Houston humidity, while I was surrounded by people who did not care about any of that. They were all fighting for their health and lives. And that's when I told myself that if I began walking again, I would never take my health for granted. And since that day, I tell myself, I remember, a bad hair day is better than a no hair day. Health is wealth. If there is no health, nothing else matters. And let me tell you that just this year, after decades of considering acting and modeling, I have begun to advocate for myself. And I've had the opportunity to act in a few short movies and dabble with some modeling. So if I can send listeners one message today, I would say focus on your health. Pay attention to what your body's telling you. Be persistent and never give up on your dreams.
Amen. You weave your stories together so beautifully, Sneha. When did you realize you were a storyteller?
I was always a comedian of some sort, telling funny stories to people at social gatherings. But it was last year that my husband pushed me to tell stories on a bigger platform such as The Moth, and I realized how much I love it.
I think the first time you step on that stage, you have a good feeling if you're a storyteller or not.
And I had that feeling. I knew that this is what I'm meant to do.
It's a very special experience, and I'm glad you stepped on there, and I'm glad you've been here to share these experiences with us. You know, and I also, you know, you always hear don't sweat the small stuff,
mm-hmm.
and it's all small stuff, and I think the experiences you talk about bring that home. I hear people gripe constantly about the silliest stuff, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm like, well, you have no idea how good you have it. You know, you're not giving yourself shots every day. You're not getting chemo every day. And you have no appreciation when you wake up that you feel awesome.
Yes, I tell my husband all the time, do not take your able-bodiedness for granted.
That's right. That's right. Sorry, Floyd's getting a little excited here. Hank, Kelly Lang, I'm sorry, you have a story within a story that fits very well with tonight's theme. Are you with us, Hank?
I am. I'm right here.
Would you tell us about it? Because I think that this is a perfect time for that story.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. And I just want to say, stay high. I love listening to your stories. You know, you dig deep without allowing us to feel like we're invading your privacy. Does that make sense?
Yes, it
And that's
does.
A great formula.
Thank you.
You know, I tuned into the Today Show one morning in 1991. Excuse my voice tonight, listeners. In time to listen to a story that always stayed in my heart, the guest spoke about her son, David Saltzman, who was an English and art major from Yale in 1989. And it was an incredible, incredible show. You know, during his senior year at Yale, this young man, David, was diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease. And for the next year and a half, he kept a comprehensive journal of his thoughts and drawings while completing a book entitled The Jester Has Lost His Jangle. In his journal, David wrote, "The best we can do is live life, enjoy it, and know it's meant to be enjoyed. Know how important and special every time, every moment is." This is what he says, "I have really lived the moment. That is all. All is that. Is such a powerful word. It was not to be, but it is. Is, to me, is alive. David died on March 2nd, 1990, 11 days before his 23rd birthday. No one wanted to publish this book, The Jester Has Lost His Jingle, but his mom took whatever money they had in her savings to publish it, and it became a New York Times bestseller. I purchased it at the MD Anderson store at Uptown Park in 1991. So without further ado, I'd like to share this story. And since our listeners are the best in the world, I'm going to ask them to create these pictures in their mind. Our story begins quite removed in a castle far away. Our story unfolds, unfortunately, on a very unfortunate day. You see, this morning when the world awoke, no one was in the mood for any kind of a joke. But one was still happy and bubbled with joy, for he played with life as you play with a toy. He would dance to its rhythm, being light on his feet. He would sing to its tune, which was gentle and sweet. For he was the jester, and gesture would be to make people laugh and fill them with glee. He had a special helper, as any jester should, a name of Farley, his friend, a piece of talking wood. So he carried Farley all over. The two were quite a pair. They viewed life as a carnival, a fun-filled, festive fair. But today, when the jester broke out in his song, how could he have known that something was wrong? When he started his routine and strutted on the stage, how could he have known that the king was in a rage? So he sang his funny song and he walked his funny walk. He danced his funny dance and he talked his funny talk. But nobody giggled, nobody yuckled, nobody laughed, and nobody chuckled. The king gave no answer. He said nothing more. He merely pointed his finger toward the front door. The jester walked out slowly, and a tear fell from his face, for he'd never left the kingdom, never wandered from this place. And once outside, the jester cried, "Oh, Farley, I fear what they say is quite true. I'm no longer funny. My career is quite through." "That's nonsense," claimed Farley. "You're still funny, I say. You were funny last week, and you'll be funny today. It seems like a nasty rumor, but laughter must be dead. The world has lost its sense of humor," Farley sadly said. "Then it isn't me at all. It's the world that must be sick. You must find that sense of humor and bring it back here real quick." So off they went, our fearless two, to bring back laughter back to you. The journey was long and the journey was rough, but the jester was strong and he was quite tough. They looked far and wide. They looked everywhere that laughter might hide. They searched in every corner, every rock and every tree. They peered into the heavens and gazed deep beneath the sea. They wandered through the country, through meadows lush and pretty. They came up on a gleaming bridge that led into a city, and they looked in vain for flowers. They heard no songs of birds, but saw lots of angry faces and heard lots of bitter words. "Everyone here is so moody. Everybody here is so mean. I must confess this city is the saddest place I've seen. Maybe someone here can tell me, maybe someone here might know, how come people aren't laughing? How come spirits are so low?" "Ask that man," Farley motioned, "that man over there, one thin in the alley with the tangles in his hair." "Okay," said the jester, "I'll give it a go. Why are you not laughing, sir? I'd really like to know." "Well, it's kind of hard to laugh and joke when you're unemployed and completely broke. I have no job, I have no money. So tell me, jester, what is so funny?" "Oh, Farley, I fear it's much worse than I thought. Is laughter something these people forgot?" "Impossible," cried Farley. "Why, that's news I couldn't bear. Ask that man with the briefcase blowing smoke in the air." "Okay," said the jester, "I'll try again. He seems you don't believe in laughing, sir. Can you please tell me why?" "Ha! That's a laugh. The best I've had in years. The world isn't a funny place. It's filled with pain and tears. Don't you read the papers? It's all there in black and white. Everything is going wrong. The jokes won't make it right. I have no time for laughter. I have no time for you. I'm sorry that's the way things are. There's nothing you can do. Don't believe him, Farley said. We know he must be wrong. Our search for laughter must continue. Time to move along. The jester looked up to the sky as he let out a woeful sigh. He fought back tears and shook his head, and then with determination said, There must be someone somewhere with a smile upon their face. There must be someone cheerful in this cold and lonely place. Say, look at that tall building. Perhaps we'll find the answer there. It's up to us to make a difference. It's up to us to care. What of her? Asked Farley, that little girl in the bed, the one who looks so fragile, with a bandage on her head. Hello, little girl, the jester said. My, how do you do? I wonder if you can tell me, how come laughter's not with you? And the little girl looked up, and her eyes were open wide. And she turned slowly to the jester, and she quietly replied, Here I lie. I have a tumor. And you ask why I have no sense of humor? I've been sick, and I'm so tired of trying. I don't feel like laughing. I just feel like crying. Sometimes I feel like crying, too, the jester whispered in her ear. But instead of letting teardrops fall, I make them disappear. Whenever I feel like crying, I smile hard instead. I turn my sadness upside down, and I stand it on its head. When I get sad or lonesome, or when I get depressed, that's when I sing my loudest and dance my very best. So won't you try, little girl? Won't you laugh with me? We'll start off very slowly with a tiny hee-hee-hee. So they sang his funny song, and they walked his funny walk. They danced his funny dance, and they talked his funny talk. And from the room there came a giggle, which echoed down the halls. And soon there came another, which bounced up down the halls. The giggle became a snicker, which grew into a guffaw, which soon became a chuckle that transformed into a ha. The jester was beside himself. He grinned a great big grin. He hugged and thanked the little girl, kissed her on the chin. Soon laughter leaped right out the window, growing louder as it flew. Can't you hear it coming? It's about to swallow you. It spread to every corner. It filled up every space. Smiles popped up everywhere. You can feel it on your face. And everyone started laughing. And then they returned to the kingdom. He leaped up into the palace and he hugged the king and queen and said, Oh, my highness, you won't believe what we've seen. Laughter isn't missing. Why, it isn't even dead. Farley and I have found it, the jester proudly said. We found that it's been hiding. We've discovered where it's been. It's hiding inside everyone. It's buried within. Laughter is like a seeding, waiting patiently to sprout. All it takes is just a push to make it pop right out. So don't keep it imprisoned or locked out of sight. Quickly release it. It won't hurt or bite. So the king said, I'll try it. I'll give it a go. And all of a sudden, out popped a ho. That's it, yelled the jester. Just let it flow. And it flowed, and it flowed. And then everybody was giggling and yuckling and laughing and chuckling. And when the jester heard those words, he smiled and started singing. He somersaulted in the air, for his bells again were ringing. So when you're feeling lonely or sad or bad or blue, remember where laughter is hiding. It's hiding inside of you.
What a story. What a story, Hank.
It's one of my favorites for a lot of reasons.
You know, one thing I love about this story is I think it personifies something I've been thinking about, that health is important. It is a wonderful thing to have, but it's not everything, because a lot of people live with pain. A lot of people live with disease. And if you have laughter, if you have people with you, if you have joy, that's the most important thing.
Yeah, and keep in mind, this was written by a terminally ill college student who died really weeks after.
He was 23 years old?
Right, yeah.
And we think we have problems.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, Kelly Lang, that you were talking about earlier, was on the show many years ago, and she wanted to tell this story. She was a former student of mine, and she said, you know what? I got a story. It's going to hurt, but I've got to tell it. I've got to tell it. So, you know what this show does? We allow people to get on and tell it. And she came on, and I'm going to ask Tatiana to play this story, please.
Your students, I went home and listened to one of your podcasts with J.J. Simmons on her book, Without Bruises. Mm-hmm. After I thought about it, J.J.'s story inspired me to tell mine. I have bruises that I carry with me. I know what it's like to feel alone, abandoned, unloved, and like no one will understand. If anyone can use my story to ignite any sort of hope or empowerment to get through their darkness, I'm happy to share it. Mental, emotional, and physical abuse is something I have dealt with my whole life. My mother was manic depressive. As a child, I didn't understand why she did the things she did. There's support groups with people that have mental illnesses, but not for those who are impacted by it. So I didn't understand why she locked herself in the closet for days, screaming, why she tried to kill herself, why she was carried out of her house on a stretcher and taken away in an ambulance, why she flung herself down the stairs, crushing my tiny 5-year-old body at the bottom while my sister ran for help. I have scars on my knees from the glass that shattered when the picture frames on the wall came down with her. I would often just have to know that Mommy can't be with us because she's in the psychiatric ward right now. Just to give you a glimpse of the few things that were my norms growing up as a kid. So I became really good at hiding. I created spaces for myself that were my safe zones. I strung Christmas lights and glittery snowflakes under my bed, and I would lay there for hours dreaming I was really a princess like in the fairy tales I would read, and my real parents would come and find me and take me away from all of this. I would sneak out of my window and ride my bike to the end of the street and climb the biggest oak tree to watch the sunset and stay there until after the streetlights came on just to stare up at the stars. Growing up with her, I wondered all the time and I begged her, why can't you just be the mom I need you to be? Why can't you just be normal? I know the answer and that there isn't one all in the same. So I shove it down a little deeper and remind myself that when I have children, I will never do this to them. She was a mastermind manipulator. She knew that she wasn't the mother that she should be, and she would throw it in my face when I asked if she could participate in, you know, something normal, like coming to my high school graduation. She would tell me things like, it just must be so nice to be so perfect and know everything then, and I keep living my excruciating life. You have no idea what it's like, the torture inside my head. So sit down, sit here now, and tell me how much you hate me. Then later, she would turn around and be the best person in the world and be everything I loved about her. She was the most magnetic person you'd ever meet. She'd swoop me up in a rush of love and shower me with presents and fun secret trips together, just us two. She made everyone she met feel like they were the most important person in the world. I've been in and out of therapy since I was 7. As a child, my mother would constantly tell me that she thinks that I have the same mental illness. She would beat me down with her words just to raise me back up. She would tell me I'm too skinny, too fat, that I didn't try hard enough, and that I was beautiful and smart and wonderful, and as long as I did my best, that's all she could ask for, and that she was proud. I just didn't know at the time that I was a kid and I hadn't had behavior modeled in a way to be able to express my anger or any emotions that was healthy. And I had a lot of anger and a lot of sadness. I never thought it was crazy, but, you know, when a crazy person keeps telling you that you are, you tend to question yourself. So I drank, I smoked, I starved myself, I made myself throw up. I swallowed pills prescribed to me to numb my pain. I screamed, I fought, and I was silent, and I acted like everything was okay. I went to college several times. I tried to go to Sam Houston State after I graduated high school in 2004. I couldn't cope at the time because my parents had just gotten a divorce. My mother abandoned me, and she left for Italy with some man. After I was always there for her, always there to wipe her tears and tell her she's okay, I was the physical barrier from her splatting on the floor at the end of the staircase. So I escaped into a man I dated. I went to SHSU, but I was so depressed, I took the remainder of my mother's sleeping pills and slept all day, missing class. I went home to him on the weekends, and he became my new hiding place. I guess he also recognized in me that I was scared, emotionally abused, and easily manipulated girl. I stopped going to school, I withdrew from SHSU, and spent every moment with him. I came over to his house one day and walked past the kitchen and quickly realized there was a table set for two with candles and a red jewelry box in the middle of a plate. I was so scared, I went to the bathroom and climbed out of the window, and I drove away. I knew somewhere deep inside of me something wasn't right with this relationship. I had no more friends. He was very controlling, and he basically wanted me to be barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen and to just be his wife. I knew I was too young to be married. I didn't want to be a mother yet, and I wanted something more for my life, so I kept driving. I drove, and I ended up getting a puppy. I went to my mom's downtown apartment where I had been staying, and he came over to talk about what had happened and act like he was understanding. He hated that I got a puppy. He said he couldn't have me love anything more than I loved him, which he told me after he broke her neck and smeared blood and feces all over the bed and the walls of the apartment, handing her limp body to me by her tiny head. I ran out of the apartment screaming, and he followed me outside and pushed me into the pool to stop my screams. He pushed me under. He pulled me up by my hair to tell me if I wasn't going to be with him, I wasn't going to be with anyone else. Distraught, I packed a small bag and left for California to be with my sister, who had already lived in a matchbox-sized apartment with two other girls while getting her master's. I spent a long time crying and severely depressed in her tiny room. My sister always has to have a plan, which she later instilled in me. So she told me to write a life plan of what I want and what I want to achieve. Starting small, I went back to community college, and I applied and went to Oklahoma State for 2 years. My family members that said that they would help me pay for my college reneged at the end of every semester, and I would have to beg and plead for them to pay my tuition. My mother would call me most of the days to tell me that she was selling her silverware, anything she can, to pay for my tuition, which was ridiculous, considering I came from a family with money, who all lived in an affluent area, and who paid for my sister to go to Smith and Pepperdine, no questions asked. I didn't understand why she was favored our whole lives, and I had literally had to beg for everything. I had to give up and come home to take care of my mother. Two of my aunts had passed away, and my mom was in and out of the psychiatric ward again after several attempts or threats of suicide. No one else could handle her or knew when she was taking her medication. I referred back to my life plan, and I was so ashamed that I had been through so much and I had deviated from it. I applied to the University of Houston downtown and started school again. This time, I had to make a promise to myself to make sure things would be different. I had to promise myself that no matter what, no one would be able to manipulate me, hurt me, or hold money over my head and stand in the way of my goals. I was not going to hide or run anymore. I was old enough at this point to apply for loans on my own without being dependent on my parents' income. I got a full-time job as a preschool teacher, and I made it a point to start their foundation with empowering the children to be who they are, to be brave, and always use their words to stand up for themselves. It had to be me to make the choice to go to school, to do better for myself, so I can create my own happiness and my own life. I had to make the choice to be on my own, to do things my way. The past has made me who I am today. I made the choice to be better than what had happened to me. It's scary leaving the comfort of what you know, even if it is abusive and unhealthy. It's what you know. For so long, I have felt like I've been running down this dark tunnel, not sure of when I'm going to reach the light at the end or even if there is an end. But I have to remind myself that there is an end, and it's what I make it this time. I have to use everything that I've been through, the good and the bad, to guide myself and my life from here on out and be better than that. My bruises will heal through the love that I show people and my determination.
Wow, that is a heavy story. Hank?
Yeah, I know. That's, you took the words right out of my mouth.
I honestly have nothing to say on that
yeah,
story.
Yeah, I mean, you know, but I have to tell you something. You know, this is one of the reasons I've been really blessed doing what I do for a living all these years. I hear these stories, and yeah, there are assignments, but you know, there's an awful lot of trust instilled between these students and me and between them and their colleagues. And this is just demonstrates that.
Wow, it certainly does. Well, friends, this is Greg Audell with Tatiana Gago in the control room, our guest Sneha Desai, and Hank Rubchek sharing stories from our vault with us. And you are listening to stories about the ever mysterious and confusing topic of healing. You are listening to us on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 for our friends in Galveston. Tatiana, this would be a good time for us to take a breather if you could fill us in on the phenomenal Houston storytelling scene.
Of course. And the growth of the Houston storytelling, really has been phenomenal. And so What's Your Story has been a major part of that. And let's start with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. The Guild hosts a story swap the fourth Tuesday of the month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel at 1500 Sunset. That's directly across from Rice University. It's a great place to listen, tell, and discuss stories with a supportive group of like-minded people. Their next swap is September 24th. And for more information about the Guild's events, go to www.houstonstorytellers.org. And while you're there, why not become a member? You can definitely do it online. And don't leave their webpage before clicking on radio program on the menu to enjoy hundreds of shows since 2008. So What's Your Story was the first storytelling scene in Houston, and it is the seed that helped grow our storytelling community. So please enjoy our past programs and continue to tune in every week for live stories that connect us with each other. And no radio, no problem, because you can catch us online at www.kpft.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And if you have program ideas, questions about storytelling, suggestions for guest storytellers, or tell us why you'd be a great guest, drop us a note at story@kpft.org, and we promise to get back to you. If you want to take your storytelling interest to the next level, the Tejas Storytelling Association and National Storytelling Network are waiting for you to become a member. You can check them out online. And our friends at The Moth hold their monthly swap on the second Tuesday of the month at Warehouse Live. The next one is September 10th, and the theme is lessons. It's another great place to listen to wonderful stories.
Well, friends, in short, listen to lots of great storytellers and start telling stories yourselves. Let me punctuate the importance of doing this. So What's Your Story is committed to helping you appreciate the art of telling more than anything else. Just like writers need to spend time reading so they know what good writing looks like, good storytellers need to listen to stories to understand how to apply features that make stories more engaging. I mean, I leave every storytelling session after listening to some good storytellers just filled with ideas on ways to improve my stories. And it doesn't really matter whether you're a first-time storyteller or whether you've been doing it for 50 years. You can learn something through someone else. Sneha, your last story has to do with healing, but not of the physical variety. Would you tell us about it?
Sure. When I was at the University of Houston for my internship in clinical psychology, one of my friends approached me for help and said, "Hey, one of my friends needs some advice but does not want to go to the counseling center. Can you help him? And he will buy you dinner in exchange." And I was excited at the prospect of free food because which poor college student isn't excited about that, right? So the next day, I met him at a restaurant and discovered that he was a doctoral student just like me, from India just like me, and a little awkward, not like me. And he told me that his English was weak and that caused him a lot of anxiety at job interviews. And I thought, wow, like this free dinner for not even psychotherapy, all he needs is a little pep talk. So I gave him some pep talk, I had my meal, and I went back home. The next day, he called me and offered to buy me dinner again. And at dinner, he told me he was worried that he was not going to graduate on time because his dissertation chair was not pleased with his progress so far, which would prevent him from going to India that upcoming Christmas break. And he hadn't been back in 6 years. So once again, I thought, wow, the free dinner for some peer mentorship. Like, this is easy. I proceeded to tell him that this is how doctoral programs work, that once we are in them, our lives are at the mercy of our professors and we just have to deal with it. And he seemed okay with the answer, and we both went about our ways. A few days later, he called me at midnight, and he told me he was locked out of his apartment. At this point, I began getting annoyed. I was not his girlfriend. I was not his best friend. I was not his on-call therapist. I was not a locksmith. So I calmly told him, call your leasing office or the after-hours emergency number. And again, he seemed okay with that. He hung up. There was no free dinner, so that's all I was willing to do. Another few days passed, and my friend, the one who introduced me to him, showed up at my door unannounced with him. Apparently, this guy was having a major panic attack and just had to see me. He looked extremely aggravated and frazzled. He told me he was afraid the cops were after him. I asked him to slow down, and I said, explain to me what's going on. And he said that his dissertation had not been approved, which meant that he could not go to India in December, which meant that he could not get married to his girlfriend, and that had angered her parents, and they were sending the cops after him. The first question that came to my mind was the first question I blurted out. You have a girlfriend? Because he'd never mentioned a girlfriend to me. And if he had one, why was he calling me at midnight when he was locked out of his apartment? Anyway, he said, yes, I have a girlfriend. And I said, why haven't I met her? He said, because she's in India. And I said, you told me you haven't been to India in 6 years. And he said, yes, I haven't. And I said, when was the last time you saw her? He said, I've never met her. At this point, I'm thinking, is this guy delusional? Is he hallucinating? Because if that is the case, then I'm not equipped to deal with that. He proceeded to tell me that he had started talking to her on a dating website 3 years ago, and they had gotten close, and he promised her that he would marry her in December, but now that he could not go to India, her parents were sending the cops after him. And I told him, look, no one gets arrested for postponing or changing their wedding plans. And he said, yeah, they do. And I said, no, they don't. And he said, in India, they do. And at this point, I began to suspect something was really wrong with this guy. I decided to log on to Google and show him how wrong he could be. But turns out he was right. Apparently in India, some men have been arrested for not marrying their girlfriends after promising it to them. But it was only because they had sex with them and then dumped them. So I told him, listen, the cops in India don't have the time nor the money to come arrest you. The cops in America have other things to worry about. You've never met this girl. You've never had sex with this girl. You're fine. So he says, what about oral sex? And I said, oral sex? I'm so confused, right? And he lifts his cell phone to his ear and goes, mum, 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 like making kissing sounds. And at that point, I realized that this guy needed a lot more help than I could give him. So I gave him the number to free legal services on campus, free health services on campus, and free counseling services on campus. And as awful as I felt, I told him I could not help him anymore. I come to find out later that this man had a psychotic episode of some sort, and had called 911 in a state of panic after I told him I could not help him, which is a bit ironic because he was scared of the cops to begin with. But I'm glad he did. Because after that, he was hospitalized in a psychiatric ward and received the services that he needed. Moral of the story. While we may have friends and people who can help us for free, there are some things that just cannot be taken lightly. Mental health is often neglected because it is so abstract. The symptoms can be so vague. In some cultures, seeking help for mental illnesses is also such a stigma, like a taboo. The truth is that mental health is as important as physical health. We would not take cancer lightly, we would not take the flu lightly. Then why do we take anxiety, depression, bipolar disorder, and all of these conditions lightly, right?
Sneha, thank you for giving us a much-needed bit of laughter after a rather heavy episode.
Oh, you're welcome. We needed that change of pace.
We did. You are a patient soul. I have no idea how I would have reacted in a similar situation, but I'm certain I would not have been as calm, cool, and collected as you were.
Oh, I had my moments, trust me.
I guess we know why you're a psychologist now. You can deal with these. And Hank, I want to thank you for bringing these powerful stories that you shared with us tonight
on the subject of healing. Oh, it's my pleasure. Always.
And friends, no matter what you are dealing with, I promise you that if you keep laughter and good stories and good people in your life, some part of you will be healed. I wholeheartedly believe that. And Sneha, I got to say one thing, since we are a dog-loving family here on our show, your husband is awesome because I saw the tattoo he got of your dog's paw.
Mm-hmm.
That is pure love. That is pure love and obviously a very good man.
And that is a gift that I gave him for Father's Day, something that he really wanted. We love our dog. He is the love of our lives.
Well, you don't have to explain that to anyone in this studio as Floyd is sound asleep in my lap right now. Well, thank you, Sneha Desai, for sharing your beautiful, moving, and absolutely hilarious stories, your unique views, and your enthusiasm for storytelling. Friends, stay put, because Lars is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters on the Tennyson tape deck. Make 90.1 a part of every single day while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling out. Join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. You keep loving great stories, and we will absolutely keep bringing them to you. This is Greg Audell, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it is absolutely, positively, never too late to live happily ever after. Peace, my friends.
Peace.
If you decided to donate your birthday to KPFT this year, thank you. If your special day hasn't yet arrived, consider donating your birthday to KPFT. Here's how it works. Facebook sends you a prompt before your birthday asking if you'd like to donate your birthday to a nonprofit. Select KPFT as your organization of choice. Then add a personalized message so that your friends know how much KPFT means to you. On your birthday, they'll receive a Facebook notification asking them to make a donation in your honor to KPFT. Thanks again for supporting 90.1 FM KPFT Houston, Pacifica Radio for Peace.
The 2019 local station board elections are underway. Visit elections.pacifica.org for candidates' written statements, video cards, and debates. As of August 15th, your ballot will come in one of three forms: an email ballot, a brightly colored postcard, or, if you requested it, a paper ballot from Honest Ballot. If you cannot find your ballot, please fill out a ballot request form on elections.pacifica.org. Members in need of a paper ballot can leave a voicemail at 510-854-9663. Paper ballot replacements will be issued through October 7th. All ballots must be received by October 15th, 11:59 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to be counted.